On this week's 51%, hear which presidential candidates appeal to millennial women.
The feminist movement has been so successful that they see Hillary Clinton as a candidate. Being a woman is neither a plus nor a minus to many of them.
A teenage girl gains medical experience in Peru, and a young man feels pressure to stick with sports over music, though professes his love for his grandmother. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I break tradition. Sometimes my tries are outside the line. To not make mistakes, but I can't live that way. Oh. Staring at the blank page before you open up the door.
For more than two decades, Anne Fishman has been at the forefront of major generational trends. Receiving four U.S. Senate research fellowships, she introduced America to lifelong learning and intergenerational mentoring by creating Senate information papers, national workshops, and help with federal legislation. In 1995, she founded Generational Targeted Marketing, which has provided generational guidance to companies large and small, and she has also worked extensively with the U.S. government. Fishman is a former adjunct professor at New York University, and she is the author of a recently published book, Marketing to the Millennial Woman. I spoke with her about what millennial women want in a presidential candidate and whether Hillary Clinton's feminism appeals to millennial women.
What Hillary needs to understand, and really all candidates need to understand, but Hillary possibly more than any of the others because she's got a disconnect right now, is the importance of connecting to the women of the millennial generation. And the reason that it's critical for her to get over this and every candidate to get over this is that there are 40 million millennial women. And to put that into perspective, that would be more people than there are Canadians or Australians or North Koreans. So for that reason, it is critical that Hillary Clinton and every other candidate be able to talk to this generation, because if motivated, they will get out and vote, and they can tip this election one way or the other.
What are they attracted to?
First of all, they are attracted to authenticity. That's why Bernie Sanders is making such a hit with them. It's more than just, I will give you a free education. Bernie Sanders is Bernie Sanders. He's been a socialist. He is a socialist. He will always be a democratic socialist. Do they even understand really what socialism means? Maybe some do and maybe some don't. But he's always preaching the same message. Authenticity really ranks high with millennials. They have been marketed to since they were little bitty things, and they know hype and spin when they see it, and they don't like it.
How important is social media in this campaign?
Social media is critical in a funny way. It's not the message, it's the messenger. Social media matters because millennials are a generation, they think in groups. They were team taught, they were team graded, they were given trophies simply for showing up for team sports. So they think in terms of their group. So if one millennial has something that she thinks is important, all of a sudden she's going to get it out through social media to her friends, to her acquaintances, and to anyone else who will listen. So pleasing one millennial is not just pleasing one millennial, it's pleasing hundreds of people, and then they go to work on their parents and their grandparents.
So it's really that share button.
Yes,
is what
yes,
you're talking
without
about,
a
right?
doubt. It's not that the message is so great in social media, it's that it's social media.
Sure. Let's go back to Hillary Clinton then. And you mentioned authenticity as being primary for the millennials and coming through via Bernie Sanders. Is it on and off via Hillary Clinton? Have you seen changes as she is being directed to, I mean, this has been a big story, right? How the female Democrats are not necessarily in her corner. It's not a given, as we open saying.
Well, I'll give you, all politicians have a problem with this because they change their minds. They see how things evolve. I'm not really that hard on politicians for changing their minds because the situation can change. That happens to all of us. But what I think where she's missed the boat a bit is that she changes sometimes her accent to fit the audience. She can drop into a southern accent in front of a southern audience. One other particular thing I saw, now these are two small examples, and it doesn't mean that a lot of the things that she's done have, you know, a lot of the things have been consistent, But at one point she sent out, I think it was a tweet, that said, where was Bernie Sanders when I was doing health care, the universal health care program? And Bernie Sanders' group tweets back, look at this picture, I was standing in the group with you. And so immediately Hillary's group tweets back, thank you for everything you did for me, Bernie, I really appreciate it, but notice you're standing behind me. So you see, it's such a rapid change of opinion there that millennials spot that, and they don't like it. They like consistency.
Is there a difference in your opinion among the millennial women versus millennial men?
The millennial women have more changes. The reason I wrote that book about millennial women, I could have written a book on millennials, but I chose to write about millennial women because there have been more changes that have gone on within the women of that generation than the men. For example, they are the first generation in American history to fully reap the benefit of Title IX, legislation passed during the Nixon years that gave federal funding only to institutions that provided sports for both men and women. Therefore, millennial women have a self-image that's brand new. They see themselves as being physically strong. They're sexy, savvy, physically strong. So that's one way that they are, that's a real new thing with millennial women. The other thing is how they view feminism. They are at least a third wave or fourth wave of feminists. The first wave were women from the silent generation. That would be women born from 1925 to 1942. That would be a person like Gloria Steinem. Then you had the second wave of feminists. That would be like Hillary Clinton, baby boomers, who helped push feminism into place, who helped women rise up. Third wave probably is Gen X, who just did what they needed to do to survive. But along comes the fourth wave, which would be millennials. Millennials have choices. They are living the goals of the feminist movement. And consequently, they make up 15% of the active military force. A woman was just selected, or is going to be selected, as the head of the first fighting combat team in the military. So they can be soldiers. They can be stay-at-home moms. They can be the primary breadwinners. They have no limits anymore, and this generation is the closest to wage parity we've ever had, and it's getting closer and closer and closer.
So they see a female candidate for president and say, wow, a woman can be president. Not that we haven't seen candidates before, obviously Hillary one of them, but others as well. That's not enough, huh?
Well, here's the thing. The feminist movement has been so successful that they see Hillary Clinton as a candidate. Being a woman is neither a plus nor a minus to many of them. We have so broken down so many of the barriers that they look at her as a candidate versus another candidate versus another candidate. Consequently, it's not about breaking through the glass ceiling as much as it is, do you really understand what my unique challenges are, the challenges of my generation? Do you understand what I need to advance and for my family to advance? So the feminist success is now becoming Hillary Clinton's worst nightmare because they have choices, and they don't have a need to elect the first woman president. In fact, many of them see that as sexist, that you would vote for someone simply because she's a woman.
Anything else you want to point out from your book? And we can certainly expand out from politics. It's such a missed opportunity for so many marketing to millennial women.
Well, it is. And as I said, they don't quite see the history behind it that's driving it. And they see young women as younger versions of themselves. And that's just not the way it is anymore. The only thing I would say to you is millennial women are a force to be reckoned with. As I said, they have jobs. A lot of them want to be stay-at-home mothers because they think it makes a real difference in their children's lives. Some choose never to get married and to raise pets. Even the Pope has given a speech on why young people should raise children instead of dogs and cats. We have every choice in the world out there for young women. And this is a group that feels very empowered. Millennial women feel empowered because of the history of their formative years. They had tremendous support from their families. They had tremendous support from society. They had tremendous support from the government. They had tremendous support from their religions. Consequently, when a young generation is given this much support, they feel empowered, capable of having good lives for themselves, with enough energy left over to help others. This generation wants to save the world.
I know this sounds like I'm harping on this, but it is really interesting, this whole Hillary Clinton phenomena, particularly the second time around. And do you see any changes in her targeting millennial women from when she first announced her candidacy to, as we saw, the rise and continued rise of Bernie Sanders, and now? Do you see any changes?
There have been some changes since Hillary Clinton started her campaign. And one of the changes is that she's taken on, instead of assuming that young women are going to vote for her because she's a woman, she's taken a page from Bernie Sanders' book, and now she says she's basically absorbed his message, but she's absorbed it too late. They understand – millennials, as I said, are very sharp. Millennial women understand that Bernie was on board from the beginning, that Hillary's absorbing it because it's a winning message. And it doesn't mean that she doesn't care about women. But it does mean that you have to be authentic from day one. And it really doesn't matter if you're Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders. Millennials like authenticity, and they really tend to vote for authenticity.
And you mentioned Bernie's message being absorbed by Hillary. What is that message?
I noticed in Hillary Clinton's latest message, during one of her speeches in an election that in a primary, I believe, she lost. And she, at that point, she switched her message to, you may not be there for me, but I'm there for you. And then she started talking about their needs and what their problems were and what their values were. And consequently, she began to go on to Bernie's, go off of the feminist, you need to vote for me because I'm a feminist or you're going to hell, to, I understand what you're going through. The candidates need to understand it's not about them, it's about the voter. And the candidates who understand that we don't really care what your wife did, what you did, what she did, whatever, do you understand what we do? Because it's really important that we elect someone who we feel understands what our needs are. And I think that Hillary's moving into that position, but the candidates who talk about us rather than themselves are the ones who seem to connect the best.
It's a really interesting point, and I did see her say that, give that message up in Boston, actually, I think about a month ago, maybe a little longer.
Yeah, I don't remember where I saw it, but I thought, oh, she's almost got it, but people realize she's almost got it.
Exactly.
Now that she's jumped over to this, because her plan, I was reading a lot of articles this morning in preparation for this,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things I read was that the campaign's philosophy was, we're going after the women, and we're going after minorities, because those are our strong bases. Well, guess what? It didn't quite work out that way. Consequently, the campaign looks and says, who is succeeding and why? And so if they had only known what the people needed at this particular moment in history, and every generation needs something a little different, but if you study generations and you say, what do young people need at this moment? Well, they need to find a way to get out of student debt. They need jobs. They need to know that their children are safe when they go to school. What do middle-aged people need? What do older people need? It's a generational, there's six generations, all of whom are Americans. We are all in the same boat together, but a candidate has to be able to address the needs of each of those generations to get us all on board, or the majority of us on board.
That was Ann Fishman, founder of Generational Targeted Marketing and author of Marketing to the Millennial Woman. At the age of 16, Jehanna Mendu went to Peru, and while there to pursue her ambition of working in the medical field, she had the chance to perform medical procedures far beyond the norm for any other high schooler. Caitlin Orr brings us the story of her peer.
Few teenagers know what they want to commit their lives to, but for one extraordinary student, she has found her purpose and passionately pursued it.
I've wanted to be a doctor for as long as I can remember, When I was little, it was like one of the many things I wanted to be. I wanted to be a pop star. I wanted to be a vet. I wanted to be a doctor. One of the main reasons I think I wanted to be a doctor is that I had a sister who passed away before I was born of a congenital heart defect. And I never got to meet her, and it always made me really sad because I always wondered what my sister was like. And I would always hear other people's stories of how great she was, and I always wished I could meet her. So I think one of the main reasons I want to be a doctor is so that I can help other kids like her with congenital heart defects.
Jihana Mandu, at the young age of 16 years old, went on the adventure of a lifetime to explore her love of working in the medical field.
One of my sister's surgeons actually started a foundation, and it's called the Hearts with Hope Foundation, and they go on medical missions to Peru. The foundation's main goal is to help kids with congenital heart defects. Surgeons from all over the country come and give their time, and they perform a lot of heart surgeries and catheterizations, and they do a lot of outreach work.
Little did Jihana know that she would soon discover an opportunity to begin helping those who have cardiovascular complications.
A little bit of the trip was like sussing out if I really wanted to be a doctor type thing, and I just had so much fun on the trip. Like, all the doctors and everyone there were so nice because they wanted to give their time, and it was just a really important experience, I think. Even, like, being a doctor is obviously something that's really hard, but they all always had a great attitude and were so happy about it. Like, they were doing the same thing that they do for, like, lots of money during the week for free, and they just had so much gratification, which was really special. And everyone on the trip had such a great attitude, and I think that's part of what made it really amazing for me, and just the whole experience that I got, a lot of hands-on experience that I would never get here in the U.S. To close the chest, first they have to close the bone with, like, a wire. And so then they're like, oh, do you want to cut the wire? So I was, like, cutting the wire, which was tying together the bone. And then they started suturing, and the doctor actually got called to go help with another surgery. And so she left the nurse practitioner and one of the residents to close. And then she says, oh, wait. Why don't you let Jihana close? And I started freaking out. I was like, I don't know how to do this. And everyone in the room was so encouraging because they were all there to teach the staff in Peru. And it was just a really welcoming environment. And they're like, no, you can do it. You'll be fine. So I actually got to help, like, stitch up the patient. And in the end, I was going from one side and the resident was going from the other side. And I had finished my half, and the nurse practitioner was like, okay, you're taking too long, just let her do it. So I just got to close, and it was really amazing. So there's just so many things that I would never be able to do here. Going to Peru was definitely an experience that was really important for me, because even though I've always known I've wanted to be a doctor, I've always, like, been kind of worried, like, oh, what if I can't do it? What if I'm just not skilled enough? And, like, being there with all those people who are so encouraging, and just, like, getting the experiences I did, I realized that it's something that I really want to do. As a little 16-year-old, I stitched up a chest. Like, that's not something, like, almost anyone can say they've done. So it was a really great experience.
I'm Katie Orr. Thank you so much for listening. For more stories, please check out openorchardproductions.org.
And now Saraya Shockley talks about her dilemma as the smart girl in school.
In high school, I was known as the smart girl. Not the fun girl or the nice girl, but the smart girl. I'm Saraya Shockley with a commentary from Youth Radio. I wasn't invited to sleepovers or to hang out on weekends. What I thought of as interesting conversation, politics, science, current events, was seen as boring or showing off. Feeling isolated, I became depressed, lonely, and withdrawn. But instead of giving in to those feelings, I tried harder socially. I threw myself into clubs, sports, and musicals, and things did get better. I made friends and built a bomb resume. And this past semester, I was rewarded with an acceptance to Harvard. Still, I worry because all my social will seems to have dried up. I'm scared that at Harvard, I won't be able to muster this sort of effort twice. I know I have to let go of my high school reservations that have held me back socially and emotionally. College is new, and I'll just have to keep reminding myself that this time it can be different. For Youth Radio, I'm Saraya Shockley.
What happened to the dream of a girl president? She's dancing in the video next to 50 Cent. Jackson. They travel in packs of two or three with their itsy bitsy doggies and their teeny weeny teens.
Often on 51%, we bring you stories about women and girls choosing hobbies or professions in male-dominated fields, or where they may be questioned. Now we go to the male side of the equation, where producer Keiko Sagami's piece features University of Montana defensive lineman Nate Bradley, who plays a Celtic lament on violin.
That's Nate Bradley playing. He's a 260-pound defensive lineman from Billings who plays for the University of Montana's football team. His hair touches his shoulders, he's wearing a wolf t-shirt and a flannel, and his teammates call him Tuna. Nate told me about this one time when he was in the sixth grade. He had just started playing football, but he was also taking violin lessons. He had a recital on the same day as a game, and well, his mom made sure he made it to the recital on time.
It's like, okay, it's time to go. And, you know, I was, you know, it's kind of embarrassing. You're around all your friends and you have to leave to go play violin from a football game. I was frustrated I couldn't do both. I really wanted to do both, but, you know, you have to choose one or the other. And
these days, he mostly chooses football. He's number 43 and not quite a starter yet, but he still manages to get playing time almost every game. There are occasional overlaps, though, including the rookie show for the new guys. He brought out his violin for that when he was a freshman, and they brought him back for an encore this year. It turns out, though, that Nate's most important performance relates to his grandmother.
My grandma lived outside of Chester, Montana, which most people don't know where that is. It's on the High Line. It's, I mean, maybe an hour, hour and a half away from Canada, way northeastern Montana. And so her funeral was in Havre, which, you know, is a tiny town. There were not a whole lot of people there. It was mostly just, you know, close family and relatives and some few friends. I didn't know most of the people. I was in, you know, I was like 15 or 14, 15 something. And, you know, most of the people there were older, like their 30s, 40s, 50s, 80s, who knows. I played a song called Ashokan Farewell. Which is a Celtic lament. I know there was a while when she would, you know, whenever she was in town, she'd like to hear me play, whenever she came to visit for holidays and that kind of thing. I mean, my memory of her is a lot different than a lot of people that knew her, just because I was, you know, a lot younger than most people. She was kind of the cute little old lady, but she was really tough, too. I mean, she lived on a farm, in a little farmhouse, I mean, like 30, 45 minutes from town, all by herself for, I don't know, years. So she was the kind of tough old lady. I really love my grandma.
In Missoula, Montana, I'm Keiko Sagami.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1394.